The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
This is where you've got to flip things on their head. Where there is risk, there is opportunity, particularly if you prepare for it. You will be rewarded if you prepare for it. Or you can stay on. You can stay on with a steady Wall Street course, and I think you will be abused by the markets. That is the highest probable outcome, but I think that choice is yours.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Honestly, Dave, I would have liked to have you as a dad, only for the fact that I don't remember my father matching anytime I wanted to buy precious metals. I don't remember him doing that, but that's how you handle things with your household.
We've started early getting them thinking in terms of saving in real money terms, so gold or silver. And anytime they're interested in taking greenbacks and converting to hard currency, happy to do that for them, and I incentivize it. Now, I've had a couple of them try to play the game where the next day they want to come right back out and have instantly have doubled their money, and we kind of put the kibosh on that.
Okay, but last week, right after our program, you know, our program comes out on Wednesday morning. A few hours later, we had this amazing gold dump in the market. Okay, it was all short contracts, huge amount, it was slanted toward the shorts. We had actually talked a little bit about that, but I think that sort of caught you off guard when you got home.
Well, I went home, and maybe it was a dour look on my face, but I just mentioned, you know, hey, the price of gold is X, Y, and Z, and, you know, silver just slipped below 1450. And you know, faster had I mentioned that than the room clears. I mean, people went running from the room, and they came back with greenbacks in hand.
These are your kids.
They were ready for the match. They knew they could maximize their dollar exchange to silver. And yeah, so I got fleeced last week.
So they drained the piggy bank to buy silver. Yeah, I think that's just a great thing, you know, with your four kids. And I don't know if you do it with your wife, but, you know, she'd be smart to think that one through.
Everybody's got a cigar box, and some are heavier than others, but it's fun to have those treasure chests.
Why don't we talk about what happened last Wednesday? Because over the last few years, all of us who own precious metals carry some scars from purposeful manipulation in the market. Now, I remember 2013 when Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs came in and dumped 400 tons of gold on the market in 2 hours. Now, it took 400 tons to cause gold to go down in a couple of days, a couple of $100. This time, the gold dump on these shorts, which, again, we alluded to before it happened, but this gold dump on the shorts was about 2.5 times what it was in 2013. And yeah, we had about an $18 drop on gold, but it certainly wasn't the effect that they had back, 5 years ago.
Yeah, last week when I said prices be damned, you know, the reality is the price that you see prints from the paper contract market.
Right.
And if you go to buy a silver eagle, a silver maple leaf, a silver round, a 100-ounce silver bar, or any gold products, you're going to find significantly higher premiums.
Premiums are starting to increase.
The real premium, the real price that you pay for physical metals is a higher price. Much higher price than that spot price.
Because it's not represented by the paper market.
Well, that's right. What you see is the difference between a paper contract and the physical market. If you want to own the real thing, you actually have to pay more for it. And that, again, is what we saw precisely in the 2008 and 2009 period. We saw increased physical demand even as the paper price was dropping and the premium started to expand. That was one of our first indicators that the price was, in fact, recovering. But back to that issue of shorts and short covering. I think this is very significant because, you know, what we implied and said specifically last week was they have to close out their trades, those short positions, which means they have to buy back a certain number of ounces of gold to lock in their profits. This happened in 2006, in 2007, in 2013, and twice in 2015. And the price gains, which occurred thereafter, were, I think, very significant. You know, so back in 2006, when you had a significant short position and they covered, 12 months later, the price of gold was 20% higher.
Right.
In 2007, when you had a significant short position and they were forced to cover, or they chose to cover, the price of gold 12 months higher was 37% higher. 2015, 12 months later, it was 22, almost 23% higher. And 2015, again, December of that year, not July, when you had another instance, almost like the one that was earlier in the year, price of gold moved up 12 months later by 8%.
So in those, all of those occasions, we had huge short contracts that were pushing the market down. Then they had to cover, like you mentioned last week. And on average, taking all those numbers that you just mentioned, on average, it was up 17.8% within 12 months.
And that includes if you average in the 2013 anomaly, where you did in the 6 months that followed have a 10% increase. But by the 12-month mark, you basically had zero change. So the one anomaly in terms of short covering and significant increase in price for the gold market was 2013. But you take all of them, and as you say, if you average them all, you end up with about a 17% increase in the price from the point they chose to cover.
Something you brought out last week, and I think it's important to go back to, is that you've got this algorithmic trading that looks at just the numbers. It doesn't really take history into account. We were talking about context. You and I both have been to the Louvre Museum, and as we stand and look at the Mona Lisa, you know, some people might be standing there saying, gosh, is she smiling or not? Or, you know, what gives this the three-dimensional feel, you know, Leonardo's technique? All of these things are contextual. But if you had a computer or a robot doing the same thing, the robot probably could tell you that the picture is a certain width and length, and it could tell you the different color schemes, but it wouldn't really understand the context. There's a lack of humanity, wisdom, whatever you want to call it, in just algorithmic trading. Now, context still matters, even though we live in a day and age where it doesn't really feel like it, does it?
Well, that's the transition we've been in for probably 20 years, is moving away from analog and moving towards digital. And there's some huge benefits to being in a digital age. You know, think about what it's like to travel cross country with your 10 favorite books. Well, in the analog world, that's a lot of weight and a lot of heft.
Right.
In the digital world, it's on an iPad or on a Kindle, and you could have 10 or you could have 10,000. It doesn't matter. There are some advantages. What you lose to some degree when you move to the digital world is the context in which facts and data exist. And you see this on Wall Street, where data becomes king, but context loses relevance. And, you know, we have a very strong opinion that context matters. And too often, it's sort of the forest is lost for the trees by both individual investors and Wall Street analysts. And, you know, for several weeks, we've referenced our friend Russell Napier as a critic of the current trend in market analysis, which is, you know, laid out nicely. The current market analysts do this in terms of spreadsheets, and they put it into a format where it's all neat and tidy, and it oftentimes neglects background issues. And it's up to and including your political and geopolitical trends, which frequently don't have an economic driver to them. They don't have an economic calculus. You find in areas, when we talked to Minxin Pei, he liked to say that the difference between the Chinese is when they make economic decisions, sometimes they have a political motive, which is different than what we might expect, right? So it's not just about maximizing shareholder returns. It's not just about growing private sector wealth. Politics end up being at times irrational, or at least seemingly irrational. Politics is almost always dirty, and this is where the surprises are within the market. Yeah, I think there's two categories of people here, either the uninitiated or the intentionally blind. You can just put your head in the sand and pretend like context, geopolitical and political issues are irrelevant. But again, this is where the contextual issues are so important. And I think, frankly, where Napier hangs out a lot as a market historian.
I've been going back, Dave, and reading some chess history. I'm not much of a chess player, but I do love reading about the characters who play chess. And oftentimes, and I hate to say this, but it leads to mental disability. The guys who become obsessed with chess, you can go
crazy.
Back and see. Yeah, you can go back and you can see that life becomes almost too difficult for them outside of the 64 squares and the 32 pieces. And I was reading a quote from Bobby Fischer, and he said, you know, what is chess other than a search for the truth? But he grew to hate the game that he actually mastered, partially because he was not able to actually handle life outside of the 64 squares. Now, and I wonder if these computer programs are similar to that. They're looking at the 64 squares. They're analyzing the perfect move, 20, 30 moves out, you know, way beyond what a human could do. But What happens when the chessboard's knocked off the table? Or a fire happens and burns the chess house down?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is what was lost to the game of chess in the move from analog to digital. The search for truth, which Bobby Fischer talked about as a part and parcel to the game, it's no longer about that. It's about maximizing moves.
Yes.
And the most precise move is the move that you're searching versus something that is perhaps more ethereal and philosophical in nature.
His favorite player was a guy named Paul Morphy, considered the romantic of chess. And a lot of the moves that Morphy made, you can go back and analyze and say that was just absolutely the wrong move. But the man was fascinating and incredible to watch because he could beat the guys who were coming up with exactly the right move. And what Bobby Fischer said, he said the thing that he hates about chess, this was right before he died, he said, the thing I hate now about chess is that it's all theoretical. At this point, it's just whoever knows the best move 15, 20 moves out. And of course, that can only happen with computer analysis.
Well, you get that same sense. Again, going back to tight analysis and a spreadsheet about what a particular asset class will do, what its correlations are, and how you measure that in terms of standard deviations and volatility. There's lots of different ways to get towards precision, but I think oftentimes you're losing the context. So
precision is optimistic. Okay, precision is basically saying things are going to get better and better. Usually when you put something into context, you've almost got somebody who's crying wolf or saying, you know what, you better be careful. Nobody likes to hear that.
And that's Napier, frankly. A market historian is often mistaken for a Cassandra because they're always right, but they're never heeded. That was the curse that Cassandra was under. And, you know, so not the person who's most welcome at cocktail parties, unless, you know, the world happens to be melting down. And then, of course, they offer some insight as to what and why. But you look at the bond market as an example, again, sort of forest and trees, and you could look at the inflows and the outflows from a particular segment of the fixed income market, that universe, and it's helpful to know kind of what's waxing and waning in popularity, where people are going, and their clues. And we talked about spreads last week and how, you know, there's a political party in Italy who's demanding the control of the spreads between bonds, right? So these details are important, but it's also relevant to recall the larger context that you're in. Here's the context for the bond market, at least here in the United States. The bottom in yields was put in 2 summers ago, which in retrospect marked, and this is our opinion, of course, but it marked the beginning of a long-term secular bear market in bonds. We're already in that. So, you know, there's the arboreal interest in the daily flows, and that sits in the context of a changed structural market backdrop.
And we've talked about that being a generational shift. You and I really don't know in our adult lives a rising interest rate market. We don't remember that because it's been falling virtually all of our adult lives.
That's right. It's a generational shift in the cost of capital. And these are shifts which play out for decades, not days. And they have a broad impact on all asset classes from equities to real estate, not just bonds of the fixed income universe. And everyone should care. And I think very few do, in large part because it's like watching paint dry. When you're talking about the shift in interest rates to higher levels or to lower levels, in either case, you know, if you wanted to try to document in real time a macro evolutionary change, I mean, you're talking about something that takes place theoretically over so long a period of time, and yet you want to march with it through the daily gyrations, you're going to miss it, or you're just going to be bored by it, bored to tears.
So if you're a real estate investor who, for the last 10, 20, 30 years, has made money with low interest rates, this is something that should be taken in mind at this point.
Not just low interest rates, but declining rates.
Yeah, there you go.
So for the real estate investor, you need to care. You need to proceed with greater caution as you structure deals and as you look at your purchases, because the next several decades, you're likely to have a few more headwinds.
So watch those adjustable rate mortgages.
Oh, sure. And for the equity investor, too, we've had the past several decades, or let's at least take this decade in particular, it has rewarded the autopilot indexer.
Right.
You know, coming in as they did at the tail end of a compression in interest rates or in yields, and at the tail end of a multi-decade decline in rates.
Well, and let's contrast that. When you say an autopilot indexer, you're actually encouraged and rewarded to not pick stocks, to not look at values, to just buy everything. You know, they call it the everything bubble. You're rewarded by not actually using discernment. Now, the opposite of that would be somebody who would be looking for value and actually having to weigh out profits, losses, debt, that type of thing.
Which is why, you know, this backdrop issue, this contextual issue, I think will redefine allocations within the equities markets for decades to come. More likely than not, we are moving towards a time frame where that old-fashioned stock picking and the higher rates of returns that we saw from that in an earlier generation, it's moving back onto the scene is relevant. And it's going to become more profitable than riding the wave of monetary excess. Because again, you've got this index craze, which obviously, if you're looking at Vanguard's history, it started in the 70s. But really, the popularity curve, if you're looking at growth in assets under management, it's only exploded in the last 10 to 15 years. It's only exploded in this period of time where monetary excess has been the primary driver. And what do I mean by that? An increase in the amount of credit that's out there and the lowering of the cost of capital, lowering of rates to get you there. The lowest rates in thousands of years. I mean, it's, so again, this is a very unique contextual play, and it played a significant role in ultimately homogenizing returns such that one of the most relevant factors in investing, and again, this is only of late, has been the expense side of the equation.
Well, okay. So when you're raising kids, one of the things you want them to understand, and you know, we talked about your kids running to their rooms and getting money because they realized that what silver cost was less than what they paid before. Cost is important in a transaction, but we've lived in a decade where cost really wasn't factored in.
Well, and I think it's always relevant, but it's not always the first consideration. And I think we're moving beyond the point at which it was super relevant. Because look, in an age of 0% interest rates,
money's free.
Yeah, like we've had, finding a fund with an expense ratio of 7 basis points, that may be key to your survival. But in a world of 4 to 6% is the benchmark in the 10-year, 7 bips is hardly a blip on the screen, right? And I think this is now, again, where we're transitioning back to the age of better thinking, likely to provide better results. And you once again will get what you pay for. So if you're paying 7 basis points, you're going to get exactly what you pay for, the average rate of return.
When you're talking about context and forest for the trees, we have to actually go beyond this last interest rate cycle. The last half of this cycle, this last half of the waveform, is where we went from high rates to low rates. Okay. We were in our 20s. I was in my 20s. You were a little younger than that. When rates actually peaked out, back in the early 80s. But if we were to go to the first part of that waveform, the rising part, we weren't even born yet. We're talking 1946 was the last time we would have been having this conversation about rates bottoming out and starting to rise.
Yeah. You know, people don't appreciate the consequence of control and command dynamics within the marketplace. But we had that during World War II. We actually had price fixing, you know, for commodities and things of that nature during our wartime effort. And you didn't have that come to an end, sort of leaving the wartime footing until about 1946. Interest rates responded first, and the equity markets didn't really start responding until, let's say, 1948 or 49. Mm-hmm. But markets gradually shifted, and, you know, the managed price dynamics went away, and the bond bear emerged from its den, and he stayed on the prowl from about 1946 to 1981. What does a bond bear look like? A steadily increase in the rise of rates. On the other side of the equation is a steadily declining value in the price of the bond, right? So the bear is on the prowl from 46 to 81. What is he doing? He's gutting and eating fixed income investors throughout an entire generation. That is hardly remembered by today's generation of investors, let alone fixed income investors. But the reversal in trend came in 1982. And it ran, if we are correct, it ran until the summer of 2016, 34 years later.
So those 35 years from 1946 to 1981, that is a long time for the bear to kick in. And now the bear's been hibernating all of our adult lives.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, hey, you know, here in Durango, we do have bear. And there are times when you hear the trash can outside shaking and you go out with the flashlight, but then you start going out with the flashlight and the sidearm because, you know, they're dangerous.
A funny story, my brother, back from Indonesia with his family, and he's staying with his other in-laws, and woke up one morning to the sound of that bear in the trash can, and he doesn't know what it is, so he opens the door, and literally 2 feet from him is the butt of a black bear, and the rest of his body is buried in the trash can. And I mean, the bear hears him, steps out, runs 10 feet away, and stands up tall. And they usually stand up when they want to know what's going on.
Right.
Well, my brother has a choice. He can either shut the door, or he can do what my little brother would do.
Oh, yeah. What would Scott do?
He runs at the bear yelling as fast as he can. He just goes,
That's Scott.
And the bear tucks tail and runs.
Right.
Now, I don't know that that would have been my choice, but that was his choice. So yeah, 1982 to 2016, that's a long time for the interest rate bear, the bond bear, to hibernate. And I think the bear is back on the prowl. You've got the shortest interest rate trend in U.S. financial market history came in at 22 years. According to Luis Yamada and Alan Shaw, Alan's an amazing analyst, started as a fundamental analyst, ultimately ran the technical analysis department at Smith Barney before he retired in 2004. But the longest term interest rate cycle, I think 37 years, if memory serves correct, with the average sitting in the upper 20s or lower 30s. In other words, it's a very long time and many days of market gyration and volatility. So yeah, look, we can talk about the trees. It's very important what happens on a daily basis within the bond market. But the most important factor, if you're thinking in terms of sort of an Aristotelian view of things, may in fact be those daily gyrations, right? I want to give the trees their due. But the aggregation of the trees, the defining of the long-term trend, I think that's foundational to appreciating the long-term strategy or proper portfolio allocation over a longer time frame.
Well, when you have these longer cycles where you go 30 or 35 years, what happens is all the models, all the investment models get designed for the last few decades, and because that's the thought. It's always going to be like this. I think about Wall Street strategy. As people get older, the strategy has been have more bonds. Okay. Fewer equities, more bonds. In a perfect world, let's say that you're in a biosphere that doesn't have these cycles. In a perfect world, maybe you would want more bonds. But if you're in a rising interest rate market, the value of those bonds is going to continue to decrease at a period of time when you're retired. You can't afford that.
Right. And the basic math that the Wall Streeters like is take 100, subtract your age from that number, and it gives you the allocation between equities and bonds. So what the math translates to is as you get older, you have a shrinking allocation to equities and an increasing allocation to bonds according to your age, as if your age is a primary consideration for market pricing. Now, this is where, again, context is key. That works if you're living in a bubble. It does not work if you have an interest rate cycle that is misaligned with your time frame to retirement.
And think about that last interest rate cycle back in 1982. How high were interest rates at that point? I know I had a mortgage that was either 14 or 15% at that time. Interest rates skyrocketed. It would have destroyed a bond portfolio.
Yeah. So, I mean, the argument goes that bonds are less volatile and less risky because you're higher in the capital stack, assuming sort of crisis dynamics. In a bankruptcy, your creditors are favored over your equity investors who typically won't get much of anything. And I think there's also that aspect of income orientation as you shift towards retirement, the replacement of income from your previous employment. So bonds have some appeal. And in a rising interest rate environment, you will be compensated with higher rates. What that really speaks to is the need to adequately ladder a portfolio if you are going to have a fixed income portfolio so that you're getting constant liquidity events which occur and allow you to recalibrate the interest rate you're receiving. But if you have to exit a fixed income portfolio at any point on a forced basis, understand that the value of your bond portfolio will be significantly diminished in that context of rising rates. You know, so again, I think there's a bit of truth to what Wall Street has put together in terms of, you know, yes, you are higher in the capital stack, and yes, they're less volatile under normal circumstances. And I think what the average investor has benefited from here recently is central bank activity in the marketplace. Central bank activity, which has pushed interest rates to unheard of levels, and that's created capital gains, which has been actually far more of the interest for the bond investor here recently than even the income component. That deliberate central bank manipulation of yield, I don't know that that gets to stay. So yeah, Wall Street bond allocations, that's fine in a particular time slice, but I don't know that it gives you enough context to make the right allocations at this point.
So one of our listeners wrote us and he said, okay, so this time Turkey is the trigger. He says, we've seen so many episodes on triggers already, Spain, Greece, etc. Is this one really going to be it this time? And, you know, it's interesting that you and I've talked about this. We really don't ever know what the trigger is. We just know that there are danger points. And we talked about Turkey last week. So let's go ahead and spend some time on Turkey, because it seems with Spain, with Greece, go ahead and talk about Italy as well. And now Turkey, there seems to be some rider on a white horse that comes in quietly and at least dispels the panic at the time.
I think for us, too, there's the contemplation of what may be the trigger, but never the assertion that this is the right trigger. And I think we've said this in the past in terms of my interest in backcountry skiing. Mm-hmm. When you go out into the backcountry, you need to analyze the snow conditions and appreciate that you're in an environment of instability, you know, where you have snow load on a certain slope angle that is just begging for any trigger. And you need to be aware of as many or all of the possible triggers and appreciate that you may, in fact, be the trigger. So there's a certain degree of caution and humility as you enter the backcountry, knowing that if you don't analyze those unstable contexts and take all possible triggers into account, you could end up dead or buried 6 feet under, you know, snow.
Dave, 2 weeks ago, I told you I went up to a gold mine with a guy who owns the gold mine. It's up near 12,000 feet. He told me a story of a guy, a miner who was up there, who he was up prospecting, and he got caught in an avalanche, literally dug his way out of an avalanche. I mean, hours and hours and hours of digging, and he survived it. And as he was working his way down from La Plata Canyon, our county manager, I won't name him, he's still our county manager, threw a stick of dynamite out of a helicopter to trigger more avalanches. They had no idea that this guy had survived an avalanche. So the guy gets covered a second time. I mean, unbelievable story. Of course, it was completely unintentional. The guy had to dig himself out of two avalanches. So when we talk about triggers, when something like that is triggered, you know, you can have an awful lot of tension on the slopes. You never know where it's going to come. You certainly don't want to have to dig yourself out
twice.
Well,
so I think this is one of the advantages that somebody like a Doug Noland has in the management of our tactical short product, because, you know, we look for cracks to begin to widen, where we begin to see fault lines and clear points of tectonic shifts. And if, in fact, they open wide, we can be 100% short. And if they close up through, they're either filled up because of the central bank interventions or what have you, we can certainly move that position back to zero in short order.
But you need to analyze where the tension is.
You analyze where it is, and you determine whether or not it is moving from bad to worse and is moving to that state of where you could describe it in hyperbolic terms.
Let's talk Turkey here for a second, because we did talk last week, and Qatar seems to have been that rider on the white horse.
Yeah, the Nadir and Lira trading we had Tuesday, all of a sudden, Wednesday, Thursday come around, and there's the discussion of $15 billion coming in from the Qatari government.
Is that really much money in relation to what they need?
Well, I'll tell you, it reversed the Lira, sent it soaring over those 3 days. $15 billion is a few more dollars than I have, and it's quite a bit of money. As we also discussed last week, though, you have Turkey's annual liquidity needs, which are about 10 times that amount, actually more than 10 times that amount. So you're talking about sort of a drop of the bucket compared to what they actually need in terms of a real fix.
So this relieved perception of a crash, but it didn't necessarily relieve the default.
Yeah, a relief rally, but we're not convinced that the worst is behind us. So you've got Mohammed Al-Arian noted last week that contagion concerns were acute enough throughout the week, even through Thursday and Friday, that they prompted numerous central banks to intervene in their own markets in order to keep those issues at bay. So you've got Argentina raising rates. You've got Hong Kong also active, stabilizing their currency. Indonesia raising rates unannounced, so by surprise to the markets. And they were all taking these actions to ensure, as countermeasures, that there was not going to be contagion from Turkey into their markets.
When you and I went to Argentina, one of the things that was really educational for us was to be in an environment where you had 40% inflation. It looks at this point that interest rates are having to start to match some of that inflation.
Yeah, Argentina seems the most extreme. Last week, they raised their benchmark a full 5 percentage points.
In a week.
And that is on top of the 40% that it was at prior to that. So you've got the benchmark interest rate in Argentina at 45%, which tells you something of what inflation looks like and what rates do or have to do to accommodate a market that is dealing with inflation realities.
Well, those poor Argentinians, unless they had some way of being in dollars or gold or something else, they were just being fried.
Do you remember the Argentinian man I sat next to en route to Buenos Aires? Again, this is a few years ago, but At that point, I think inflation was between 30 and 35%. So it's a little bit more now. He was a Nike shoe manufacturer. So actually a contractor. He didn't work for Nike, but they outsourced some of their manufacturing to various people. One of the reasons they do that is so that the commodity swings do not hit Nike's bottom line, they hit the contractor's bottom line. Mm. So they're somewhat insulated from the change of the price of rubber or the price of oil as it hits the synthetic materials that go into the creation of shoes.
Hadn't this guy padded his contract, though, from at least his own personal pay from those swings?
Yeah, so his company still had some exchange rate risk and commodity rate risk in that contract with Nike, but he did carve out a compensation piece which tied to the US dollar. He personally was paid on an adjustable rate tied to the inflation rate versus the dollar, right? Which to him was the equivalent of getting a 30 to 40% nominal increase in pay each year. And that basically kept him at the same level as a consumer in terms of its purchasing power. Obviously, that is a rare carve out. Not all Argentines, not all Turks are so lucky. And so just that comes to mind. But Ellerian was considering too that those external funding needs of Turkey, they far outstrip the Qatari gift. And his assumption was that they will be moving to the IMF very soon, that those loans from the IMF will be needed. Or, as we suggested last week, maybe a new benefactor from the East.
Yeah, you brought up that China might be willing to step in on something like that. But more significant, Dave, is you've got an awful lot of twists and turns and different alliances in the Middle East. We have Saudi Arabia and Israel that are sort of unhappy allies because of some of the changes in Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Qatar. You've got Qatar who's fighting right now. They're fighting with Egypt and Saudi Arabia. So what does this mean for the Middle East? Because we have Kamran Bakari on every once in a while, and he explains some of these dynamics. And as complex as they are, a lot of them add up to the void that was created when Saddam Hussein was taken out of Iraq, which was sort of the central piece. You had Iran on one side trying to fill that vacuum. You had Turkey on the other trying to fill that vacuum. We talk about the Ottoman Empire with Turkey. This Qatar Turkey relationship. Why would Qatar send them $15 billion unless there's a larger plan?
Well, and that's the deal. I think because Qatar is on the outs with Egypt, Qatar is on the outs with Saudi Arabia, there's been tensions there in the Middle East. And so the Turks helped the Qataris, you know, a few years back, and now they're kind of returning the favor. Mm. But who is allied with whom in the Middle East will take on more significance in the months and years ahead. I read this anecdotally, and maybe I need to confirm it before I even mention it, but young couple decides to ride their bikes through ISIS territory, you know, sort of trying to prove that there will be peace in our time and that, frankly, there's aspects of the Muslim religion that are completely misunderstood. And, you know, tragically, that couple died last week, as the story is told. And I'm going to double check that. But there's realities in the Middle East and real struggles. And the idea of the caliphate is not just an idea. It's a reality to many people. The reestablishment of a caliphate is something that is intended, and it's a timeless goal. So to see struggles, to see alliances, to see different countries organizing their finances and support, I think it's worth considering what the Middle East looks like over the next 10 or 15 years. Keep in mind, it was when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. My boys were playing Risk the other day, and I was explaining to my younger son that he would probably survive there in Afghanistan. The Mujahideen were amazing fighters. They knew their mountainous landscape very well, and like a Tennessee tick, they were tough to dig out. And, you know, the U.S. has largely failed in that effort, and the Russians failed before us. They could not get it done. But the whole point of the Russians coming into Afghanistan in the first place is they wanted control of the oil fields. So, I mean, lest we forget, oil is still a vital product. We can think in terms of solar, we can think in terms of alternative energy, but we still live in a world that is dominated by coal and crude. And so the people who control those oil flows, we have to pay attention, because ultimately it plays into a world of inflation or lack thereof.
When you have the combined struggle of these imperial powers, whether it's the Soviet Union back when they were around, the United States, Russia, China, they have their own agendas. But in these areas, you also have have tribalism. And, you know, as we talk to Kamaran Bakari, the thing that's very difficult for people to understand is that the Muslims are fighting each other. You have the Sunnis, you have the Shias, you have the Mujahideen, which is also tribal. You have what's going on in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi. You've got all these different dynamics.
And even the personal interests within family factions within the Saudi royal family.
Well, exactly. Now let's go to South Africa, because when I first came to work for your dad back in the 1980s, he was warning about South Africa. He says this is a beautiful country. Granted, they've got problems, but there are imperial forces that want to take over. The Soviet Union had designs on South Africa, and you had different dynamics. And the press was portraying it as a completely racial issue. Now, I know that it wasn't, because your dad would bring back people from South Africa that were black, that were in fear for their families, not because of them being black or white, but because of the tribe that they were in, the dominating tribe.
And it is true, there were racial concerns all throughout that period of apartheid. But the grand strategy of the Soviet Union at the time was to not only control the resources in the Middle East and the oil flows there, but also South Africa. Why? Because between Russia and the Soviet Union, you've got 98% of the world's strategic mineral reserves. In other words, you cannot make today's bombers or circuitry that goes into the creation of the computer networks that keep our world going as it is without these two strategic players.
Well, and so they went into Afghanistan in the late 1970s, and that was part of that push. You mentioned the Mujahideen. And then, of course, they were also working their way into South Africa using the racial problems as a method to get the world on their side.
Well, where this ties in this week is that, you know, we have emerging market concerns, which for the last month or so we've talked about. South Africa is certainly in that mix, and you begin to see flight capital as foreign investors reappraise all of your emerging market players. But the Rand did not recover. Some of your emerging market currencies started to recover last week as the U.S. and China started to say, hey, listen, we're going to come back to the table. We will talk. Everything's going to be
fine. But the Rand continued to just free fall.
Right. And Qatar suggested, hey, listen, we've got $15 billion. We're willing to help. And the lira starts to recover. And this is your exception to the rule here, where the Rand was still in free fall. And I think there is more to the story there. Chinese and the U.S. officials, yes, we hit the panic button and the PR campaign came out and we're going to have some talks either just before or just after the election, I forget, but sometime in November. And I think this ties to Ramaphosa, and Ramaphosa is mimicking Zimbabwe's land confiscation and redistribution.
Ramaphosa being the head of South Africa right now.
Yep, head of the ANC party and current big chief. So it has begun. That land confiscation and redistribution has begun. That is, white farms are being seized, given to blacks. There's no compensation for the land which is being taken. And so this is basically South Africa's Mugabe has arrived.
We talked to the two gentlemen who had their farms taken away in Rhodesia under Mugabe.
I think it's worth going back to the archives and listening to that interview, because it's a very chilling story. Yeah, there was a member of the royal family, British royal family, who was a client of ours, who had about $100 million worth of land in Rhodesia, left, drove, this is classic, drove her Rolls Royce south to the border. And the only thing that she had with her was the Rolls Royce and three diamond rings, all turned inward so that the diamonds weren't obvious. And she was allowed to exit. She exported her car to Southern California and rebuilt what she could of a real estate sales empire off of what had been sort of, you know, wealth created from the breadbasket in Rhodesia. Needless to say, it was a very different world for her. Didn't matter that she had family and was well connected in Britain. Her world changed dramatically. She chose to get out and left $100 million worth of property behind.
And she probably made a good decision.
I think she probably did make a good decision. Because I think confiscation and reallocation in South Africa, if this is truly a Mugabe moment in South Africa, this is not even the socialist or communist dictum of according to ability and according to need, where the communists prescribed, you're talking about redistribution according to race and tribe, which,
right.
I mean, I can hardly wrap my mind around. But I think at this point we can say, and I think time will prove, that the whole lingering discussion over apartheid, because it's lingering, is naive. It's out of date. It applied prior to Mandela. It really doesn't apply anymore. And to me, and again, I'm certainly open to discussion on this, but it's like seeing racism as a defining factor in our culture here in the United States today. Past tense, absolutely, I agree. It has been an issue. Present tense, really? We elected a black president not once, but twice. I mean, you know, I think anyone who's playing that card today is driving simply for greater redistribution of resources and is playing off the past. They're not living in the present.
There seems to always be a larger agenda.
And this is where party politics comes into play on this particular issue. You know, we have a cultural dialogue on this issue, but it plays to those who are trying to whip up concerns. Again, black-owned businesses here in the U.S. increased by 400% in the last year. The fastest segment of new businesses to grow in the United States and to open are owned by black females. This is fantastic. There is greater equality in 2018 in the U.S. than at any other time in American history. It's not to say that it can't continue to improve, but we're talking about 98% of Americans, which I think are colorblind, 2% which are not. Mm-hmm. But I think for those 2%, they should not be the ones defining the cultural debate. And where it is being defined in those terms, I think you're talking about political hacks who actually benefit from a divided nation and love to heap as much fuel on the fire as they can.
Well, I'll never forget when your dad brought back a man who was a mayor of a township. And again, he was part of the wrong tribe. He was black, and he wanted to let us know here in the United States his family was in danger for him even being here. This was a Christian man who was talking about the truth of what was going on in South Africa was much deeper than racism. Now we're starting to see this social justice going the other way.
Well, and I think the rant on social justice in South Africa is probably a decade old. It's been around too long. I think Mandela brought very positive change. He brought an end to real race disparity. But post-Mandela, you've got South Africa, which has devolved into that tribalist reverse racism. I mean, visit there if you want to experience it firsthand, but have a conversation with the Indian community. They lament being the wrong color because they're not dark enough. You talk to Zulus, and they lament not being from the tribe of the ruling party, the ANC, which is the cause of tribe. Black-on-black injustice has been common since the days of Mandela. And I mean, really, this is, think about this. God forbid you're colored. That's what black South Africans describe as a person of a mixed race parentage, right? Coloreds are in a truly difficult social space in South Africa.
Or even Zulu.
And so keep in mind, we have a very open conversation about race here in the United States. You go to Africa and it's actually a little bit more complicated and you find that color is not really the issue, but you can have exclusion and prejudice which goes beyond race. And again, it's fascinating. The social justice warrior cry, I think it's a cover. I think it's a cover for theft and a justification for graft. You had South Africa. If they wanted equality for everyone, they had the opportunity. And equality of opportunity is really what I'm talking about. And you saw that Mbeki and Zuma, they could have solidified that on their watch. But what they opened the door for, both of them, Mbeki first and Zuma, very clearly, they opened the door for the worst kind of political opportunism. The rule of law is something that is quickly slipping from the South African country.
So do you see a reprieve from this, or is the rand doomed?
Well, so I think when we look at emerging markets as an opportunity to buy and invest in individual countries, you know, this is a very important aspect, this rule of law. The rand, I think, is going to visit every circle of hell, just like the Zimbabwean currency did, if this insanity doesn't stop. But you've got investors and foreign capital. They may fear giving a critical voice to Ramaphosa's policies, fearing sort of the racist tag, but they will nevertheless vote with their feet.
Right. So the investors will leave.
Yep. So, I mean, if I were a South African, I would consider immigration. If you're not directly tied to the ANC, I would consider immigration. Whether you are white or Indian or black, it doesn't matter. South Africa is moving past that point of no return. That's not to say that it can't do an about face at any point. But if you're invested in a company with South African assets, what should you be doing right now? Again, this is where context absolutely matters. You're talking about the radical deterioration of the rule of law, the elimination of property rights with zero compensation after confiscation. And again, this goes back to context. The rand may tick up today, it may tick down tomorrow, but the bigger picture is sad. Constitutional changes set in motion by Mandela They brought about hope for lasting change in South Africa. But gradually, this has been compromised. It was Mbeki first. It collapsed completely under Zuma. You realize when he left office, there were 750 separate corruption charges with Jacob Zuma. And now, frankly, in terms of that issue of constitutional formality and protection under Ramaphosa, you're talking about it being non-existent, right? So it could have been different, but South Africa today reflects most of the African continent, not all, but most of the African continent, where tribe and family tree define your opportunities. And I think the big opportunity that they've had has been squandered. An opportunity to lead, an opportunity to demonstrate difference. It's been squandered to demonstrate reconciliation. It happened once, and now it's being set aside. Forgiveness and cooperation based on mutual respect, on shared values, on individual equality and
well,
dignity.
Well, let's address equality. Okay, remember Orwell talked about this in Animal Farm. Okay, equality only exists for those who are a little bit more equal than others.
Well, that's right. So some pigs are more equal than others, and that's what it seems to be. The gist of current policies in South Africa, you need to be connected directly to the upper echelon of the ANC. But listen, for the record, I want to make this very clear. Our family is not racist in any way. With open arms and an incredibly open heart, we embraced a man from Nigeria into our family, my sister's marriage partner, years ago. So don't misunderstand this criticism. Anyone who feels that my opinion is too sharp-edged or has a racial tone, you need to stop it. This has everything to do with a reading of current events from the standpoint of Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to read that before you start writing nasty comments, because you might think about unintended consequences and policies that have a rationale to them or seem to be justified, but are ultimately devastating. So please, please, please read Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France, and you'll understand where I'm coming from.
Sometimes you have to have a construct that reminds you that historically man is evil. Chief Justice Ginsburg was looking at the South African Constitution and saying, gosh, if we were to rewrite it today, this would be the one that we would use. But in actuality, that's just sort of applying situational ethics at the time, is it not?
Well, it is, because the basis of that quote was the embracing of basic human rights, right? That was her focus. And you're right. She said, I would not look to the U.S. Constitution. This is our chief justice.
Right.
This is galling.
This is what, 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
It is. So in all fairness, context is key. It was then, not now. I would not look to the U.S. Constitution, she said, if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012. I might look at the Constitution of South Africa because of its embrace of basic human rights. Well, look, the difference between our constitution and theirs is that ours has stood the test of time, one of the few in all of history to stretch as far as it has through time, providing a protective cover from governmental or interpersonal abuse. And where it has failed on those fronts, the necessary amendments have been made for it to become more inclusive and a better document. Theirs is failing in less than 25 years.
One of the contacts that you have that has been on our show a number of times is Hernando de Soto. And he talks about the rule of law and contract law, the ability to hold property that you actually own. What we're seeing is, in South Africa, just one more occasion of the breakdown of that law.
It's a pillar for investment, the stability factor, the rule of law. And emerging markets, what are they? They're speculation on global growth. But they are, given that, much higher risk. And where you begin to see money go in or money go out, we talked about liquidity last week and current concerns of liquidity. If there is concern that you can't get your money out of an investment, you generally see a mass stampede to the doors, right? So you have to have guarantees. This is what we talked about last week in terms of Turkey and this cross-border problem. You don't have access to the collateral when capital controls are raised, right? There's been a practice of capital controls in South Africa for decades. I remember in the 90s, your limitation was you could extract no more than 25,000 rand per year per person leaving. Right. So if you were a South African citizen, that was your limitation.
Well, one of Hernando de Soto's points is, his main point, is that poverty is an outcome of a breakdown of the rule of law and private property rights. And abundance follows the rule of law. When you have the rule of law and you have property rights that are adhered to by a constitutional mandate, then you have abundance.
That's right. This is what is so frustrating. When I imagine South Africa 10 years or 20 years from now, by eliminating this aspect of the rule of law and property rights, you are destining yourself. You are creating your destiny, which is one of poverty.
Yep.
That's right. So Hernando de Soto, if you haven't read The Mystery of Capital, again, a classic book, you must read it. Must read it. But where law is overridden, where law is overridden by human greed, by avarice, what you have is corruption, which comes to define the landscape. Corruption defines the landscape. There's always in that place going to be underdevelopment, not a continuation of development. Instead of having a developing or an emerging economy, we go back to having a submerging economy, right? I'm not sure we don't have our own sort of whitewashed version of corruption here in the United States. So I'm not saying that somehow we are the city on the shining hill, perfect beyond measure, applying the rule of law perfectly. In fact, there's been erosions of that. Okay. I would concede that gladly. But you look at Francis Fukuyama as an example. He considered the ability of some countries to grow based on one aspect and one aspect alone, trust, right? So delegation comes with trust, and you're able to expand and grow, whether it's an enterprise or a country, when you have this element of trust. And I would suggest that the rule of law is an undergirding aspect to that, creating accountability, bringing transparency, and a willingness to trust. But trust, where it's extended, where it's protected by the rule of law, is that much more possible. It's a possibility. Fukuyama, what he was observing in his book, the title of it is Trust, he's observing underdevelopment due to a lack of trust extended. And it's typically underdevelopment in a place where you depend on control according to family or tribe.
Okay, so for the sake of context, which we started the program with, we're going to bring the context back, because the final analysis in this is an algorithm is not going to be able to figure out at all what you just now talked about. We talked about family history. We talked about national history. We talked about contract law. We talked about all these things because these are context for risk and opportunity. This goes back to the fact that these algorithms are not going to win in the long run.
Well, that's right. So risk and reward, those two things, they end up straddling these core backdrop issues. Yes, there's greater growth opportunities that exist in the emerging markets. There's no doubt, not only in terms of population boom and natural resource availability and underdevelopment, moving to overdevelopment there. They are immature economies relative to the more mature Western economies. But yes, the risk is concentrated there too, with a more tenuous implementation of the rule of law. So look to those countries that have a robust application of the rule of law and are on the younger side. And yes, you've got a healthy growth dynamic. But we begin to see shifts in the credit markets. We begin to see a preference here in recent weeks for sort of risk off. And it's not a surprise at all to see the emerging markets return to that submerging market category, where the risks are recognized, and frankly, there's no amount of reward which is adequate. I mean, think about that. 45% interest rates are not enough in Argentina to bring people in, right? This is amazing. Just to illustrate, we will ultimately see a full cycle of risk off. And look, we've had central bankers, their short-term interventionist measures, they seem to make it irrelevant, right? But I think it's the traffic of individuals voting with their feet, heading to the exits. They will define market prices going forward. Till then, what do we have? The continual volatile, massive market swings, whether it's, you know, the lira up 8% one day, down 16% the next. It's a tug of war. It's a tug of war. That's truly what's happening, the tug of war between command control and free market dynamics.
Yeah, we talked about the tug of war between imperial forces and tribalism. Okay, that's going to go on for an awfully long time. But the tug of war between command and control, where people think that you can just have artificial interest rates, you can print money and not have any real consequence to that. Command and control only lasts so long, because actually free market dynamics, that's not just an ideology. That's like gravity. That's the law of nature. Free market is the law of nature.
It's an aggregation of individuals operating according to self-interest.
Right.
Why do free markets continue to function, and why are they predictable as the winner in the end? Because when you aggregate free choice, when you aggregate an expression of self-interest, you ultimately overwhelm bureaucratic management. They're trying to manage prices and signals, but that is where ultimately markets, I think, break down as free markets express themselves in an overwhelming fashion.
You had mentioned the word signals, and in our life, we're continually analyzing signals. You just read a book about deleting certain things. You're now reading a book on memorizing certain things. Our minds can only handle certain amount of data at a time. So what we have to do is we have to forget that which is unimportant. We have to see that which is important, or at least remember that which is important. Those are called signals, and whoever sees the greatest amount of signals, or the things that apply the most, that's the winner of the game. Remember when we interviewed Pippa Malmgren, the author of the book called Signals?
Yeah, just as important as the title is the subtitle, The Breakdown of the Social Contract and the Rise of Geopolitics. As we've suggested for weeks, you get emerging markets, which are a signal.
That's a signal.
You get industrial commodities, which are a signal.
Another signal.
I'm glad everyone's enthusiastic about a 4.1% GDP growth here in the United States. But commodities are telling you a different story about global economic activity and growth. Shrinking global liquidity, as we talked about from the Gave Cow guys last week, it's a signal. The days are long, but the years are short. You know that phrase. And it's not too long before these signals reveal the underlying weaknesses in the global financial structure. Where there is risk, and we see it increasing daily, this is where you've got to flip things on their head. Where there is risk, there is opportunity, particularly if you prepare for it. You will be rewarded if you prepare for it. Or you can stay on. You can stay on with a steady Wall Street course, and I think you will be abused by the markets. That is the highest probable outcome, but I think that choice is yours.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.